Okay, at this time we'll call the meeting, this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Time is, looks like 1:05 p.m. on Monday, March 7th, 2011. Members present include Representative Gardner, Representative Munoz, Representative Dick, Representative Herron, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. Purpose of our meeting today, we're going to take up two bills, House Bill 97 to extend the invasive plants law, which is sponsored by Representative Craig Johnson, and followed by Governor's Bill HB 106 for the Coastal Management Program. We'll hear HB 97 first, and presenting for Representative Johnson is his aide, Jean Yasnes.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Jeannie Osnes. I work for Representative Craig Johnson. And this bill is deleting a sunset clause to a position that the Division of Ag, Department of DNR, has had for 2 years. In your packets, you have the accomplishments that that position has done over the past 3 years, 2 years, excuse me. And one of the things that I'd like to mention is the third page of that accomplishment is some of the grant writing that he was able to do and bring into this state funds over the amount of money that he was given as a personnel to the state. House Bill 330 was the beginning of this position. The two-year sunset allowed $80,000. That gave that position a paycheck. It didn't give them travel, didn't give them computer, didn't give them anything except to show up and try and work it out with DNR and Division of Ag to put together a plan for the state of Alaska. We, at this point, don't really have a lot of policy dealing with the invasive weeds, and one of the projects that this position had was to bring together a state plan, and that is almost complete. All of the public comment has happened on it. But the letters of support you've received are from many of the organizations that deal with the land around Alaska, deal with the people of Alaska, the soil and water conservation districts. And then we also have the Alaska Committee on Noxious and Invasive Plant Management. And a number of people volunteer with these organizations to try and deal with the weeds that are in their specific areas. We do have a lot of people online that would speak to this in an expert mode. I do want to show you this one colored map that isn't really a map, excuse me, it's a graph. This is the way a weed, an invasive species, can take over. And you can see on the bottom left is the first occurrence of something showing up. And it would be something like the hairy vetch or reed canary grass, and how it reacts with the area around it and what it can do. Right now, most of the experts are saying we're at the bottom of that S-curve and ready to go into the high growth period. This last summer, I don't know if you noticed, there was a huge spurt in dandelions, for one, and many other weeds, the white clover, sweet white clover, and the hairy vetch. So basically what this position will do is help bring together the number of people working around the state trying to deal with weeds as they appear and begin to cause problems. This last year in Ketchikan, one of the awards given out was to a Coast Guard fellow who found this egg high on the top of a conning tower of a ship that came in from Japan. This is a gypsy moth egg mass. And if this were to come into the Tongass National Forest, it would definitely be an agricultural pest. And this is some of the things that the state has to begin to worry about. Anchor River, for one, has sort of been saying they can't do anything about it anymore. There's so much reed canary grass, they need to take care of smaller areas first, smaller infestations. So that's what this position is doing, making priorities, discussing policy, and trying to save the state from spending a lot of money. One thing, for instance, the governor of Idaho put in, let's see, this is back in 2007, put in $6 million just to fight noxious weeds in his state, and $4 million just to deal with Eurasian milfoil, which is a water plant, one species. And, of course, they are a much smaller state and have a lot less water throughout their state than we do. So it can be a costly problem, and this position would hopefully save the state millions by doing what we hope is a rapid response to handle whatever has infested the state.
That's it. Questions from the committee? Representative Gardner?
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm sort of curious about why it was originally a two-year plan, and I think you said that was just because of the cost. And I see that the fiscal note, you said, was $80,000, and the fiscal note now is 101, and that difference is travel?
But, well, it's more than travel. It is also the supplies, I believe, that that position would use, as well as
right, yeah.
contracts out to maybe survey areas.
Thank you. Yeah, I see that. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the committee for Ms. Osmus? Representative Dick?
I have a question. I've heard nothing but good about this program. Everybody feeling very worthwhile, but I've also heard, and I don't even know the name of the individual that's done this job, but it seems to be a lot of the success is the direct result of the personality and persistence and dedication of the person doing the job. If we were to remove the sunset on this, wouldn't the possibility exist that down the road somebody else might have that same position with less diligence? I guess that's my question.
Well, I'm sure the position does need somebody who's going to be a coordinating type person, I don't know the exact job description as DNR has it, but I'm sure there's a full vetting process for this position. Should the one who's there now decide not to work here and we go out again, that it is a position that is spread widely throughout the state. I'm not sure if we go outside yet for that position. I think it's Alaska first. I'm sure DNR has a way of vetting out who that person would be personality-wise, as well as the qualifications that they have.
Quick follow-up.
Representative Dick.
I ran as a conservative, so I need to make sure that we're not growing government. If we're going to grow government, we don't, you know, it's with a specific purpose and it's with an intent. And, again, I've heard nothing but good about this, but the reservation in my heart is 10 years from now, is this going to have the same diligence and same focus and same energy that it seems to have had so far?
In my estimation, in speaking with the volunteer groups around the state, as well as the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and one of the handouts you received just today was a summary of a report done by some funds that came through ARRA, through U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or through the forestry, excuse me, and through them down to the Soil and Water Conservation District. And they could not have done $1 million worth of work without him. And so, you know, the state has to at some point begin to make policy decisions. And it doesn't happen without somebody working that that job. And I think in the long run, spending, you know, $100,000 now, you're going to be saving millions in the end.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. I also support the bill. Thank you for presenting it. In the backup material, you stated that the project coordinator has initiated four priority invasive species control projects. Are those funded at the local level? How are those specific efforts accomplished, and how are they funded?
You're talking about the weed management projects, is that right? We have the person online. If I think that'd be a better person to ask. The coordinator is on for questions. Gino Graziano.
He'll be testifying.
I could wait.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, Gene. At this point, we'll open up public testimony on House Bill 97. See, here in the room, Mr. David Lend, is it Lendron?
Lendrum.
Lendrum. And if you would state your name for the record.
My name is David Lendrum, and I own and operate Landscape Alaska, a nursery and landscape contracting business here. I'm the landscape superintendent for the University of Alaska Southeast. I'm a five generations agriculture family. I came here doing the nursery business, and there were very few lawns in town when I started. And when the coordinator of the invasive species group, Mr. Graziano, came and visited me, I was not particularly enthused because my view was, well, they're going to tell me that some of the things that I'm planting and selling here are going to be on a prohibited list, and I'm not very, very excited about that. But I'm a convert. I'm wholeheartedly a convert here, and in the last 2 years, I have worked with this SNPM organization, and I've gone to their meetings and conferences, and I've met the people that are involved in doing the projects, both the surveying and policy-setting professionals from the agencies and the on-the-ground hands working groups. And the expertise and the size of the problems are way more than I ever imagined. And as our climates change, the plant materials change, and the materials that are moving into our state now, maybe 100 years ago wouldn't have caused as much trouble, but they are really going to cause troubles now. And there are things about invasive species biology that have been revealed to me, and one of the things is that many of these species have advantages. Either they start earlier in the season, or they last longer in the season, or they occupy niches that would not otherwise be occupied by something else. And there's a few species here that are, you know, they're absolutely nearly out of control now. And one of them is a sweet white clover growing around the Fairbanks area. And it's something that requires that the seed be abraded so it gets into the water system on the rivers, and as the spring melt goes and the seeds get rolled along the gravel edges and then they wash up onto the edges, they displace everything. And those rivers there now have a stand waist to chest high as far as you can see of this rapid spreading leguminous plant, so it doesn't need fertilizer. It takes the long days and grows like mad, and a single plant puts out 10,000 seeds a year. It's phenomenal how fast this stuff spreads. Well, Alaska's in a pretty good position still because invasive plants have to follow a highway system too. They need a way to get around. They need to be introduced into places. And there's a lot of our state that has had virtually no introduction. But those areas which are prone to infestation, they're vulnerable. And there are not just plant species. This organization addresses marine species, insect species. There are, this particular position focuses on plants, but the whole organization looks at the larger numbers. So I went to the invasive species conference last year in Fairbanks, and there are underwater invasive plants that are spreading in the harbor areas that they've never seen before in Alaska and have no control measures for, that are covering the ocean floor. These are things that need, they need work, they need prohibition, they need energy going toward them. And as far as your question, Representative Dick, about this particular gentleman, what I have been overwhelmed by has been the depth of dedication and the, not just from Mr. Graziano, but throughout this whole organization, the people involved with it have taken it up with a fervor you don't normally see. It's it has become a calling for many of these people, and they are from all age groups and all economic standards and various lifestyles, and I'm pretty impressed. I'd be glad to take any questions if you had any.
Questions from the committee? Representative Gardner.
Initially, I thought this is great, really important, and after your description, which can be a little terrifying, but what chance do we have?
This is the only thing. It's like, you got to get going now, you know. And other states are I grew up in California, you know, whose environment has been pretty much overcome by European invaders. There's very little of the native habitat left. Even those things that we think of when we look at California, we think of, oh, yes, that's the wild landscape, but, you know, that's not what was here or what was there. What we see now are things which have taken the place of the things that were there before. And it is only through the concentrated effort of early detection and rapid response that the first indicators and the first invaders are able to be dealt with. There are things that you may not be able to do anything about. But those things which come and come in small numbers and get started, those are the ones to really focus on.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Lehner.
Thank you.
Okay, got a couple folks online that are going to testify. First one we'll take is Francie Havemeister, Director of the Division of Ag. Ms. Havemeister, are you on?
Yes, sir, I am. Through the chair, I'm just calling in to answer questions. This program has been housed within the division for just under 3 years. As you've heard, it has been successful, and I'm just basically here to answer any of the committee's questions.
Any questions for Ms. Havemeister? Representative Kalasak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Frank, for being here. Can you explain the we were mentioning a little bit earlier about invasive weeds in waters, why that's not something that's done under the Division of Ag?
Right. Through the chair, if I could refer that question to Gino Graziano, he is also in the room with myself. He can address that.
And Mr. Graziano, would you be able to answer that question?
Yeah. So what we're currently working on with you know, the kind of submerged aquatic invasive species is figuring out between Fish and Game and Division of Ag who actually does manage those. Within DNR, I haven't heard an attorney general's opinion on it, but I've heard some folks who've mentioned that, you know, DNR manages the substrate of a riverbed, and so, you know, therefore it would be under DNR, and so that would kind of fall to Division of Ag working with lands. Or, you know, and others, you know, point to things where, you know, Fish and Game manages the harvest of seaweed. And that might be their purview. So we're working on that. The general feeling that I get, or consensus that I get, is that it's probably a DNR issue, and we would be managing that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Graziano. And just for the record, indicate, please, that we've been joined by Representatives Kawasaki, Wilson, and Foster. Okay, next up we have from the UAF Cooperative Extension in Kenai, Ms. Janice Chumley. Ms. Chumley?
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my testimony. I'm here in support of House Bill 97. Throughout the years when invasive plants have been being noted in the state as a growing menace to our wildlife habitat, our fisheries, and our agriculture, the one sticking point is there's never been a point person through the Division of Ag that can coordinate all of these activities. And so with being splintered throughout the state and different plants in different locations because the state's so big, I think it's really important to have someone in this position that can coordinate statewide efforts to address these invasive species. And I really would support the continuing of his position or her position in the future, whoever might hold it. I honestly think that without one person coordinating it at this point in time, all the efforts will be splintered and we will not be able to proceed. Alaska still has the ability to contain or eradicate some of the species in the state, and we really need to take efforts to make that happen. And so I really would like the support of this position to be continued. And if you have any questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Chumley. Any questions from the committee? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. For Mr. Graziano.
Mr. Graziano, are you still there?
Yes.
Hello. I was curious how a community can work with you to coordinate a specific project, or how do you identify a specific project, and what's involved in coordinating that effort?
Typically, a community is either will form a cooperative weed management area, getting interested organizations and individuals involved in invasive species management. So, that brings to the table a Department of Transportation, DNR, any of the federal land managers as well as municipal land managers if it happens to be in a community like that. And so I will typically work with groups like that, to help them get organized, help identify projects, and help find funding for projects. An example is in Fairbanks, they have a cooperative weed management area that's led by the Soil and Water Conservation District. And when one of their weed management area members found common water weed, Lodia canadensis, up there as first discovery in Alaska. And so I've joined in on their meetings to try to start addressing that. And most recently was on a teleconference to try to find some strategies on getting funds to actually do more survey and management of that weed.
Follow up for Representative Munoz.
In Juneau here, we have a problem with the plant called Japanese knotweed, and I was wondering if that had been brought to your attention.
Yes, I've worked with the Juneau weed management area through they had been working through the Juneau Watershed Partnership, and they seem to be doing what they can with Japanese knotweed. And in Southeast, Japanese knotweed is a really entrenched invasive plant, and the strategy has been to start to remove it from some of the natural areas it's moving into to keep it from getting into those places. As well, in addition to just having correspondence with those folks, I've had quite a few correspondences with the Department of Transportation when they're particularly when they're doing construction projects, and they've heard there's an invasive species coordinator in the Division of Ag, and they know Japanese knotweed is an issue to deal with. If they happen to have the knotweed in their construction area, I've worked to help them identify cheap and easy ways to take care of it, like disposing of the fill material in a safe place or underneath the pavement, things like that.
Great. Thank you.
And any other questions from the committee? Next up, we have Mr. Bryce Wrigley from Delta Junction. Mr. Wrigley?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can. If you would, state your name for the record.
My name is Bryce Wrigley. I appreciate the opportunity through the chair. I'm a farmer in Delta Junction. I raise about 1,000 acres per year of barley and wheat. We're currently working to provide Alaska-grown grains for human consumption. As over the years, I've watched as invasive weeds have moved into the state and that represent a direct threat to our ability to provide a sellable product in the Alaska market. Several years ago, we were fortunate that Canada thistle was discovered in one of the local fields. The Cooperative Extension Service and the Delta Farm Bureau coordinated an effort to eradicate it before it could spread. Later, the Soil and Water Conservation District took over the noxious weed effort in this area. Well, it took 18 years to eradicate that patch of Canada thistle, but we haven't had any in the area for at least the last 13 years. My concern as a producer is that we as a state are doing too little to address this problem while it's in its infancy. We've talked before about the window of opportunity that's available to us to control the spread of invasive plants, but one day this window of opportunity will close. It'll never again be as cheap nor as easy to address the invasive weed problem as it is right now. In my opinion, the solution is a long-term commitment by the state to manage invasive species, beginning with a point man. Now, this legislation, HB 97, addresses the sunset for genus positions. If you'll recall, a couple years ago when we were talking about HB 330 that created this position, one of the reasons was so that a state weed coordinator could be hired and develop a state weed plan, which was necessary to bring in federal dollars to help fund the weed management in Alaska. And I also would like to draw your attention to, I think it's the third sheet on your handout there, Gino's report, that when he talked about the grants that he received, there was an $80,000 grant, federal grant, that was turned back because there were no matching funds for that grant. If we don't pay to address this issue right now, then we're most definitely going to be paying for it later. I would suggest that the committee include a mechanism not only sunset genos or to remove the sunset for genos position, but also include a mechanism to match the federal dollars so that the investment by the state can be maximized. Without an effective weed management plan for the state, the cost to me and my fellow farmers will continue to increase, but the cost to the state will grow exponentially. So I would encourage you to fund the position, remove the sunset clause so that this is not a continuing thing, but in the process also provide for a mechanism so that those grant funds that Gino or whoever holds this position goes after can be utilized and not turned back. The result is half the cost and we really need to be doing more in the state to address that problem. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Wrigley? Thank you, Mr. Wrigley. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is Lori Zomseal, I believe, from Anchorage.
Yes, thank you. My name is Lori Zomseal. Everyone should be in receipt of an email that I sent last week, and so I won't go into a lot of detail about my history in this issue other than to say my husband Troy and I, back at the very beginning of this issue, were the constituents who found a Canada thistle growing in a plant that we purchased at a retail box store. And we only had a minimum amount of knowledge about how serious that was, but we did a little investigating. And with the help of the Cooperative Extension, realized, you know, just how noxious and invasive a weed Canada thistle is. And when we got no satisfactory response from the retail box store all the way to their corporate level, we contacted the Division of Ag. And that sort of started the journey for us because the Division of Ag had no staff, no funding, nobody really even to take our report about something so serious that I ended up being passed all the way to the director of the Division of Ag. What I found through being a bit of an indignant voter and taxpayer was that in Anchorage, where I'm from, all the federal agencies from the Department of Interior had a person working on this issue. The state of Alaska had nobody. The municipality of Anchorage had nobody. And it was just to an amateur, it was obvious that multiple people spinning in individual orbits were not going to accomplish anything positive enough to handle this problem. So creating a position for an advocate for the state of Alaska, not just somebody for the parks, not just somebody for the forestry, but an advocate for the state of Alaska seems like such an important, incredibly important thing to do to bring us into the battle, so to speak, and not just be the battlefield to be overrun. I want to say when Representative Johnson responded to us in 2007, we made a commitment to him that we would do everything we could to make our fellow property owners and taxpayers understand that spending a dollar of our money now would save us $100 later, because truly this is an issue that will grow exponentially and is growing. Even with effort, it's still going. And if we lose the momentum of this position, it will be so costly to the state of Alaska, to everybody from salmon fishermen to property owners to farmers. And it's so imperative that the momentum keep going and be uninterrupted. As a result of mine and Troy's involvement, we've been invited to speak all over the country. And everybody's eyes are on Alaska. People who are involved in this up to their ears in other states, who have budgets of tens of millions of dollars and who deal with losses in agricultural, horticultural losses in tens of millions of dollars, they are looking at Alaska, and without fail they say to us, you guys are where we were 20 or 30 years ago, and man, I wish I had it to do over again and not waited to see how bad the problem was going to get, because by their very definition, once these things get control, it's nearly impossible. And Ms. Gardner, I understand your position about being terrified, because that's exactly how Troy and I felt. And I think you were at one of the early community council meetings that we spoke at in support of House Bill 330. So I would just like to encourage the continuation of Gino's position. It's important. It matters on so many levels.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Amsel. We have a question from Representative Gardner.
And thank you, and Laurie, for remembering, because I do remember that particular meeting. And when I'm reading your letter here and thinking about the concern about imported or foreign plants kind of crowding out local, indigenous, and the impact on fish and wildlife, and we've heard testimony about that today, at the same time, I wouldn't know a Canada thistle if I saw one, and I wouldn't be alarmed by something growing in a pot. So I'm just, can you talk a little bit about the impact of
this? To reach assistance, press 0. To enter a breakout session, press 1. To dial a phone number or get all...
booth, and they had the small little pocket weed guide that talked about invasive plants in Alaska. And it was a totally foreign concept to us. We had no idea what invasive plants were, but we flipped through it, and literally a month later, we found a Canada thistle growing in our backyard in Anchorage. And so, you know, that sort of heightened our awareness. And then that very next spring, when we were purchasing garden starts, we found a Canada thistle growing in a pot in a retail box store in Anchorage. And so we had, you know, an inkling that that was a bad thing. We took it, had it identified by Cooperative Extension to be certain. I spent about 30 minutes on the internet just Googling, and in 30 minutes I was pretty mad, and in 60 minutes I was an activist. And to address something that Ms. Munoz was talking about, what can citizens locally do, I'm here to say that as a citizen, not an expert, nobody, my husband and I have no scientific background at all. We both have full-time jobs. But because we recognize the seriousness of this, as citizens, we created our own nonprofit. We did that ourselves. We started the CWMA in Anchorage. It was important. It mattered. We dedicated a lot of time for about 3 years to this. And so a concerned citizen with a voice and a passion can really accomplish something. And this particular issue is such a good example of that. And as one other side note, I'll just say that there is federal legislation introduced by Senator Harry Reid that is being co-sponsored by Senators Murkowski and Begich. At Troy and I's request, we met with them in D.C. and asked them. And we also asked Congressman Young to introduce a House companion bill. And everyone laughed at us. They said, Congressman Young doesn't do environmental bills. But he did. And he introduced it the day after Senator Reid introduced his bill. And that's something that we're very proud of, to demonstrate how much impact a citizen can have on the process.
Mr. Chair, just in follow-up, thank you very much. I think you could be an inspiration for a lot of people who have a passion about something and don't know where to get started.
Thank you.
And a note of caution, Ms. Somcel, you might you keep this up, you might turn into a representative someday.
Probably not.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, also available online, we have Mr. Blaine Spellman. He's from the from Fairbanks with the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts. Mr. Spellman, are you there?
Yes, I am. We wrote a letter of support for House Bill 97, and I'm more than willing to answer any questions that how we feel that the Division of Ag's program has benefited our efforts in managing invasive plants around the state.
Well, I guess I'll ask you the question directly then. How effective do you think this the coordinator position has been in terms of actual coordination?
I feel that he's the Division of Ag. As has been stated before, the soil and water conservation districts have been managing invasive plants for a very long time. And as Janice Chumley pointed out, it was kind of a uncoordinated effort. Oftentimes, you could have one district working on a project in isolation of another district, or a nonprofit working in isolation with another, with just working in complete isolation. And I feel having a state coordinator with the Division of Ag has been exceptionally important, because you can unify all these nonprofits, soil and water conservation districts together as a team working with the state. So personally, I feel like that position, and not only the position, but the strategic plan that the Division of Ag has come out with, is very valuable.
Well, thank you, Mr. Spellman. Any other questions from the committee? Do we have anyone else online to testify? Okay. Take a brief at ease. Meeting of the committee back into order. And we have no one else online to testify, correct? Anybody else in the room that's interested in testifying on this bill? This time we'll close public testimony, and the chair will entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee.
Before that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
I'd just like to make a comment. One of the coordinators, local coordinators, Dave Cannon, gave me a presentation on this before we came down here, and obviously it's surprising how much we don't know about invasive species. You know, these pretty little flowers that we want to grow that are not native to Alaska and really are disasters. This is not related to the legislation, which I support, but the legislature needs to think about creating an Alaska seed bank or encourage more of a seed bank, and then seriously is like the global seed bank in Norway, is Alaska should explore and consider a seed vault so that we can truly save native plants species for the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Right. Yeah, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move HB 97
27LS0161/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And hearing no objections, we'll go ahead and pass this one out of committee.
Thank you very much.
And we'll take a brief at ease while the paperwork gets signed. House Resources back to committee. Our next order of business will be to consider House Bill 106, which is the governor's bill to extend the Alaska Coastal Management Program. Here to testify on that will be Randy Bates. He's the director of the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management from DNR.
Chair Feige, co-chair Seaton, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Randy Bates. I am the director of the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management. With me today in the audience is the DNR Deputy Commissioner, Joe Baelish. Most of you have had the pleasure of getting to know him as well. DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan extends his regrets that he cannot be here with you today for the introduction of the governor's bill. But he wanted me to impress upon you his engagement on this bill and his interest in this issue. Three topics I'll cover today in as brief a moment as I can. There's three things. Number one, an overview of the governor's bill, House Bill 106, why this bill is necessary. Number two, the overview of the ACMP, a brief synopsis of what the program is, its history, the changes that have been made in general. And number three, a very brief overview of the ACMP audit that was conducted in the last several months. House Bill 106, a brief overview. Senate Bill 102 from 2005 amended Alaska Statute 44.66.020A to include the Alaska Coastal Management Program as a program subject to termination. This provision provided the legislature with a mandatory review of the ACMP's efficacy through the program sunset process within that statute. This provision of Senate Bill 102 also included an uncodified section that terminates the ACMP on July 1, 2011. The termination of the ACMP through this provision is not like your normal sunset provision. There is no grace period. There is no program wind down. It is effective immediately, July 1st, 2011, which means a bill must be passed this session extending the ACMP, otherwise the program terminates. Recognizing the value of the Alaska Coastal Management Program to extend our state authorities to federal lands and agency activities, as well as the importance of incorporating local participation and input into those decisions, Governor Parnell has introduced House Bill 106, extending the termination date of the ACMP by 6 years. The governor, the department, and my division thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today, and as I suspect, several more hearings in front of us. Very brief overview of the ACMP, its history, the changes, just so you have a good background of what has happened, the value of the program, and why things were changed. The ACMP, and if I could, Chair, co-chair members of the committee, some of this material is included within a brief DNR overview I gave, I think, back in February. I did not include additional information today. Much of this overview was the subject of a previous presentation I gave to you. The ACMP is a federally authorized voluntary state program where the state oversees the responsible development of coastal uses and resources, federal activities within the coastal zone, and activities on the outer continental shelf. The primary tool to implement the program is the consistency review process. Through the consistency review process, proposed resource development projects, like a dock, like an exploration project for oil and gas, that range of project. resource development activities are reviewed for compliance with the ACMP state standards and district enforceable policies. Many permitted activities located within our state's coastal zone are subject to the ACMP, where federal agencies, state agencies, coastal districts, and interested public members evaluate the project to help determine whether the project is consistent and compliant with the ACMP standards and district enforceable policies. The ACMP, as it's currently structured and as it's always been structured since 1979, includes the most expansive coastal zone in the nation. It extends, for the most part, all the way up to either Alpine or the ice fields in southeast Alaska, all the way around western Alaska, central, south central Alaska, several hundred miles inland up anadromous waterways to the headwaters of those spawning areas. It is the most expansive in the nation by far. Also important is we expand the coastal zone out to the 3-mile territorial limit with the opportunity to look at additional activities that are occurring on their outer continental shelf. And we have that provision. We're, again, one of the only states in the nation that has what's called a geographic location description in federal terms that allows us to extend our coastal program out to the outer continental shelf, the edge of the outer continental shelf. The state chose this network-structured program where state departments and divisions participate in the implementation of the ACMP. And we also recognize and include a local component where several coastal municipalities and service areas voluntarily participate in the implementation of the ACMP. My division, Coastal and Ocean Management, serves as the lead agency and is responsible for all aspects of implementation of the coastal management program. In 2003, there were changes that were initiated to the Coastal Management Program. Executive Order 106 was introduced, moving the Division of Governmental Coordination into the Department of Natural Resources. House Bill 191 was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor in May of that year, 2003. House Bill 191 brought about change in the following ways. The intention of that bill was to reduce delays and avoid regulatory confusion, costly litigation, and uncertainty to allow new investment in Alaska. The intention of 191 was also to update and reform the ACMP statewide standards and district enforceable policies to be clear, concise, more uniform, related to specific concerns, and in the case of districts, to local concerns, and to be non-duplicative of state and federal laws. The key changes that were affected in 2003 included the elimination of the Coastal Policy Council, which was the governing body of the coastal program. And that bill also transferred all the duties from the Coastal Policy Council into DNR. The bill also required a complete rewrite of the statewide standards and the coastal district plans and the enforceable policies to ensure that all the standards and district policies met with the legislative intent to be clear, concise, not susceptible to subjective interpretation, and not duplicative of otherwise existing requirements. The bill clarified that district enforceable policies may not address a matter regulated or authorized by state or federal law unless the policy related specifically to a matter of local concern. The bill provided important clarifications on the consistency review process to provide more predictable timelines and standards, including the scope of the project subject to review, when a project can proceed in phases, the extent to which projects inland of the coastal zone are subject to review, and it encouraged the expansion of the use of general permits and otherwise expedited consistency reviews. And the last key change that occurred within that House Bill 191 was the implementation of the DEC carve-out, excluding DEC permits from the coordinated consistency review process of the ACMP and prohibiting coastal districts from establishing enforceable policies addressing air, land, and water quality that are already covered by DEC. Beyond House Bill 191 in 2003, the ACMP regulations were amended in 2004 as required by House Bill 191. Following that, in 2005, Senate Bill 102 was passed, and that provided clarifying edits as follows. It provided the legislature with a mandatory review of the ACMP's efficacy through the sunset provisions, as I mentioned. It amended the deadlines for coastal districts to submit their amended coastal district plans. It immediately repealed district policies that were in conflict with existing law. And it mandated revision to the ABC list, including those activities that qualify for an expedited review under the ACMP. Our federal granting agency and oversight body, OCRM, approved those changes 6 months later in December 2005 after conducting NEPA on after performing the NEPA analysis on all of those changes. There were pre-2003 35 coastal districts, 33 of which had coastal district plans approved. As the requirement, House Bill 191, 28 coastal district plans revised their entire plan, 25 of which are in place now, one of which is pending. We have it back under final review with our federal granting agency, OCRM. So I would say within the next month or two, I hope to have the 26th district plan online and approved. As a preliminary to the termination of the ACMP and as a result of the sunset provisions in that statute, there, Senator Olson last year requested a full program audit on the program, on the ACMP. House Bill 106, the governor's bill on the extension, is a simple extension of the ACMP that takes into account the findings from the audit on this program. The audit, delivered in two parts, was a significant investment in time by the Division of Legislative Audit that conducted the audit, the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management that responded to and provided information for the audit, as well as the numerous networked agencies, coastal districts, and other participants that responded to and participated in the audit efforts. From the administration's perspective, the audit represents a comprehensive and objective review and evaluation of the ACMP. The audit findings included, and I'll just name a few bullets, the program is operated and functioning consistent with statutes, regulations, and legislative intent. Clarifying the ACMP standards and district enforceable policies and reducing the redundancy in the program were the legislature's intent. The ACMP changes have not diminished the state's rights under the CZMA, the Coastal Zone Management Act. DNR is an appropriate agency to administer the ACMP. The audit did not recommend any statutory changes. The audit concluded that the legislature should reauthorize the ACMP. The audit findings also identified ways to improve the ACMP, the coastal program. Although the ACMP, and these are, again, two findings from one of the two parts of the audit, although the ACMP is operated openly and transparently, there are certain aspects of its process where openness and transparency are deficient. Another bullet, changes have lessened consensus building among review participants. Okay. Those are findings and statements directly out of those two parts of the audit. The division and the department are contemplating ways to improve the program as identified within the audit findings. With these audit findings in hand and based on the governor's guiding principles on resource management as it relates to the ACMP, the governor has introduced House Bill 106, a six-year extension of the termination date for the ACMP. We thank you for your consideration of this bill. I thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. Bates? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Randy, has your department decided to make any changes according to the recommendations that they gave?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. At this time, as I mentioned, we are considering and contemplating appropriate changes to be made to be responsive to the audit findings. At this time, the governor has not introduced statutory changes, but we are contemplating other types of changes that would still accomplish and accommodate the findings from the audit.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
The report didn't suggest any statutory changes, but it did, I would imagine it would be changes in your regulations, and is that what you're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. While the audit did not find statutory changes necessary or warranted, we recognize that there are improvements that we as a division and we as a department could make to increase the effectiveness and delivery of the coastal program. Absolutely. Our responses to the audit are largely captured within the audit findings themselves. That's part of in the back of each of those parts, you'll see our response to what those findings are. While there are certain changes we can and we feel we could and should make, there's other aspects of the audit that we responded to clarify some of the issues. So at this time, we have not decided or determined what would be appropriate regulatory versus procedural issues to address some of the points that were raised.
Wilson.
Do you have any idea of what time frame you're talking about, some of the things that you're looking at and will look at to make some changes? What kind of a time frame are we talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the majority of our time right now, and I suspect for the next 45 days, is going to be dedicated to being responsive to this committee and these bodies on these bills, on this bill and the other side. As time permits, we will certainly debate and engage in what we can do based on what the findings are and see what we can do procedurally and, as I said, regulatorily to solve some of the issues raised. We want to be a functional and effective division and program.
Just one more, and then I'll pass off. Do you think that there's any kind of personalities in here that maybe would make a difference if it was a different person in a certain position? I have no idea. No one has said anything to me at all. I'm just asking.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I listened to the testimony on the last bill. And rave reviews on one of the DNR employees, and maybe that person is making the program. You know, I don't know if that's the case in this situation, and I'm not sure who you might be representing or suggesting. Let me say that my position is a challenging position to administer a program in compliance with state and federal law. The decisions that I have to make out of my office are not always easy, and they're certainly not well-received by all the players that are out there. And I think that's important to recognize, considering that this program affects the industry in a significantly valuable way or significantly important way. And equally so, the coastal districts are affected by these decisions that we make, as are the public and as are the state agencies. So my position and my office need to be responsive to a great number of participants out there. The decisions we make are not always supported or always embraced by anybody or everybody. If you're not talking about my position and whether you are or not, everybody in this arena has an opinion about these changes. There's very few people that are ambivalent as to whether this program is functioning appropriately or not. And I think that tension is good. It creates dialogue. It creates opportunity for us to decide what we want as a program. So I don't think that anybody should be excluded from the process grasp. I think that the more conversation we have, the more dialogue, the more understanding, the better perspective we have, the better decisions we're going to make.
Okay. And
Representative Wilson.
Thank you very much. And I had absolutely no one in mind. No one has even asked me to talk to me or anything, so I don't want you to think that
no problem.
That came from somewhere, because it just came. Okay, thank you.
Representative Heron, and then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bates, we talked about 191 and year 2003. Could you share two examples of significant delays of projects or projects that were stopped because of the laws prior to 2003?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, off the top of my head, while I've been with the division for plenty of time before 2003, I don't have a list of projects that are in my hand. However, we did provide some information to both of the co-chairs here that they asked for some information dating back 5 years prior to 2003 on project reviews and timeframes and numbers, and that might provide a little bit of information to your question. If what you're interested in is specific project examples, I'm certain that we can come up with something for you in terms of projects. I know that I rewrote the consistency review regulations 6AZ50 in 2002, and at that time, one of the complaints about the program in 2002 was that there was no legal certainty to the timeframes associated with project reviews. And while I don't either want to remember or not that I don't want to remember, it's that I don't have particular examples in mind, but I do know that there were projects that were stopped for review, and there was no legal reason to do that from the division's perspective. We just stopped it because we needed more time to consider things, either how to massage them into findings or address a legal issue or something else. And so the regulations were written at one time to address some of that as an issue.
Mr. Chairman.
And just note, we've been joined by Representative Osterman in the gallery. Representative Heron.
Look forward to your office providing that that information to the co-chairs. Two more questions, Mr. Chairman. I've been reviewing some of the correspondence that co-chairs have asked districts for comments on this legislation, and it's universal. They all want it to be extended, but they want some returns to pre-2003. So, for example, the council, and so they can have a legitimate local input into this. So is this legislation considered that? Or do you want just an extension?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, first a question, then a response to your inquiry. Is your request for information the material that I provided the two co-chairs? The data that we generated a couple weeks ago relating back to consistency reviews for the past 10 years?
Okay. I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I rephrase it. The written testimony that we received from districts is they want to return to some of the issues that were pre- 191,
right.
For example, a coastal policy council or board, local, what they call, some are saying, genuine, legitimate local input. Does this proposed legislation do that?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, I apologize if my question wasn't clear. I was going to get to that, but you had asked, or you had made a statement, you'd like to see the list of material provided, and what I wanted to know was it the material that I had already given the two co-chairs that you're looking for? And that's it. That's separate from the other issue that you asked about, substantive changes.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, it's a data dump of all, mm-hmm. That's what we received. So it was not a list of projects that were were analyzed as those that were delayed. I mean, it's just a list of all the projects, but we'll pass those around. We can, it looked like how many trees did we want to kill for? and so it's not that there was any intention by either of the co-chairs to not supply that, but it's basically just a data dump listing all the permits that would have been issued in the last so many years. So it was not really very meaningful as to the request that I think you have at this time.
Mr. Chairman, that's fine. Appreciate that. Mr. Okay. Bates says that the information hasn't been provided. No, I don't want any more trees knocked down for that. But again, I guess going to, in the proposed legislation, some of the concerns that the district has, they all want to extend it. That's not the issue here. But they also want to return to some of those other items, including a board, what I would call legitimate, genuine local input. Is that in the proposed legislation that we have in front of us? Does that include?
Thank you. Through the chair, Co-Chair Seaton, thank you for helping clarify the issue and providing the material. Representative Seaton, thank you. Representative Herron, thank you. I think we are fortunate that all of the coastal districts and others that I've heard from are supportive of extending the program. Obviously, the ACMP is a valuable program. It's meaningful at the local level. It's certainly meaningful at the state level for our opportunity to influence federal activities and federal agency permitted activities, particularly on federal land and waters. The governor is not proposing any statutory amendments to the coastal program through this legislation. House Bill 106 is an extension, and that's it. We understand that Representative Jewell and possibly members of the other body might be submitting bills proposing substantive amendments to the ACMP. We recognize that there may be some work on that front. We are prepared to evaluate those bills and engage constructively with interested parties. The governor and the department's engagement on any proposed amendments to the ACMP will be guided by the following four principles. The ACMP must maintain a predictable process. The ACMP must be maintained as a strong state program where participant input is valued. The ACMP standards and enforceable policies must be objective and must not duplicate or redefine existing authorities. And coastal districts should be afforded a meaningful role for input on projects, but should not possess a veto decision over projects. And since I suspect many of you will want to understand what those are, I'd be happy to repeat them if that's in the interest of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, one final question.
Representative
Mr. Bates. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. And I don't think any district wants veto power or local control. They just want legitimate, genuine local input. But the final question is, the way I read the audit is suggesting 4 years. The governor's asking for six, and then there is a Senate bill that is talking about 1 year. So could you talk about 6, 4, and 1, please?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I'd be happy to do the math and add them together and call it good. That would be my preference. 6, 4, 1. The importance is the program is extended. The governor put forward the idea of a six-year extension. That was 6 years, largely based on 2005 to 2011, 2011, 2017. It seems reasonable. Certainly should put us in a position where in 6 years from now, whether we're all here or not, the legislature will have the opportunity to look at the program, determine whether it's functioning effectively or not, and make a decision on its survivability or termination. We're pleased to know that the audit also recognized the value of the program and recommended a four-year extension. That's great. I don't think that there's too much difference other than we don't want to have to go through this too often just to determine the value of the ACMP. The one-year extension, I think, is a little bit more challenging for the administration to consider, as my staff needs some security. This program needs some security. We need to be able to get down to business. And coming back a year from now and debating the value of the ACMP is not, in our minds, in the best interest of the people involved. There are two issues at stake here. One of them is the extension of the program, which in and of itself is a big doggone deal. The other issue is program change, and we don't necessarily want to see those two things linked. We don't want the program survivability linked to program change. They're separate issues. We want to deal with them separately to the extent we can.
One final comment.
Representative Herr.
Not a question, Mr. Bates, but just an observation is that maybe the governor is willing to negotiate on the length of the extension. But I think that I'll disagree with you that I don't think you can sever the two issues, the length of the extension or the issues that a lot of districts and a lot of people want to have, where we not return to pre-2003, but there be, again, a board and significant legitimate valued input, using the word you use, valued input, is that I in my personal opinion, the length of the extension and those concerns addressed by many people are truly non-severable. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Randy. Could you tell me how many enforceable policies existed prior to 2003 local enforceable policies, and of those, how many exceeded state and federal law or regulation?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I do not have the number at the top of my head. I do believe that that was one of the numbers included within the audit, and I'm certain that I could find it in short order. I do believe that the Division of Legislative Audit calculated those numbers, calculated how many were approved, and made some percentage remarks about those, but I don't have them off the top of my head.
Could you
follow up for Representative?
Thank you. Could you follow up with the committee on those numbers, please?
Through the chair, I will do that. Can I? Through the chair.
Go ahead, Ms. Smith.
Clarification. So you're looking for the number of pre-2003 policies, and then what is the next number you're looking for? And the reason I ask that is in 2005 there was that bill that immediately terminated any district enforceable policies that were rendered duplicative with existing state or federal law. And while we did not as a division go through and cull the policies at that time, that was certainly a bill that had a significant effect on the district policies. The next number that you might be thinking of is then how many policies did the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management finally approve in district plans? So if, and I'm just, excuse me, throwing out some ideas so I can get the numbers you want. Pre-2003 enforceable policies, 2007-08 final district policy numbers, is that the type of answer scenario you're looking for?
Chair, yeah, I do. I would like to be able to compare how many policies existed prior to 2005 or 2003, and then what the effect was with the change. How many remained in place after the change?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, so I will follow up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm looking at a letter that was written to you by, January 27th from Representative Herron and Representative Foster, and the penultimate paragraph, one of my favorite words, says that the Bering Strait CRSA has had to rely on volunteer help in a small contract funded last year. We'd like to know why ACMP Section 306 funds can't be used for contracts. And in your response to that letter, you're talking about your responses of February 24th and page 5, where there's discussion about the audits The most troubling of all four audits was the audit for BSCRSA, unable to account for any of the money received. This is $250,000. On the next page, you say criminal prosecutions were not warranted. Civil action may be warranted. Decided not to pursue civil action and chose to close the issue. So, and I'm trying to understand what's happening here, and it looks to me like there's been a problem with maybe leadership or having the right people for the job. I mean, I'm curious to know, is this just sort of a lack of experience in leadership? Is there negligence? Is there some malfeasance here? I'd like to know what this is about.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, thank you for the question. First, I believe we just resolved some of these issues with the Bering Straits Coastal Resource Service Area and have engaged in funding them again, and that's within the last month. So what that means is that they are back on track. They're a full participant with the program, and that we've resolved these longstanding financial issues to the satisfaction of ourselves, of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, our federal funding agency, as well as the CRSA board and members. This is a longstanding issue that was uncovered in a program financial audit of the Bering Straits CRSA. And it was an independent audit performed by one of the accountants around accountant firms around the state that, when they did the audit, could not account for a little more than $250,000. And the reason for that, over the course of three fiscal years, there were no check stubs. My understanding, there was no check history. The money was spent, but there was no accountability in terms of how the money was spent. We, as our division, as a responsible facilitator and program implementer, we took that issue seriously. We looked into it. We shared this with the Department of Law. The Department of Law looked at the issue, looked at the accountability of the issue, and we were able to move beyond any criminal or civil proceedings. Our goal was to get the CRSA cleared of charges, get them set up financially, and get them back on track so that they could be a full participant receiving money in the ACMP. And it has just unfortunately taken a fair bit of time to get to that point. We are there.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Just a question. Which letter are you referring to?
It starts with a letter of January 27th to Randy Bates, and the response is a many-page letter of February 24th. And it's on bottom of page 5, where there's the subheading, the audit. And then it kind of...
Okay. Yeah, go ahead with your follow-up there.
Thank you. So what I'm trying to understand is, was this $250,000 used appropriately and the record-keeping was shoddy, or was there a concern that the money could not be accounted for and was not possibly used appropriately?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I don't necessarily think it's my place to cast doubt or other in terms of how the money was spent. We recognized there was a problem in terms of financial accountability. We worked with the personnel from the Bering Straits, representing the Bering Straits, and they worked well on the program. So I don't know, you know, I'm not going to make a judgment. It's not my place to do so. We recognized that there were some financial accountability issues that we needed to address and resolve, and that was our goal. And to this point, to this day, we have now done that. After this audit was performed, finished, we performed audits on the other three CRSAs. And the reason we did those four CRSAs in total is they are an entity solely for purposes of coastal management. There is no other organizational structure to them. We fund them about $73,000 to $75,000 a year, which pays for personnel staff time, a bookkeeper, office space, and all other things. They have a minimal matching requirement of about 25%, but they exist for the entirety of coastal management. The other 24 coastal districts are municipalities who are under control of their Title 29 municipal authorities, and as such, they are accountable for their monies and they're audited on a regular basis. So,
follow up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So what you're saying in a roundabout way is you cannot or are not able to answer the question about whether the $250,000 was used appropriately for Coastal Zone Management Program.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I do not have an answer to the question in terms of whether it was spent appropriately or not. The money was not identified in terms of where it went, how it was used. And so it's difficult recognizing that to make any judgments. And again, it's not necessarily our place to do so, and we don't have any information that would suggest it was inappropriately spent. We don't have any information in terms of how it was spent. We wanted to get the Bering Strait CRSA's financial programmatic bookkeeping in line so that they could receive monies again. And fact is, when we couldn't account for the money, when the issues came out, we terminated the opportunity for that CRSA to receive any further funding until we could resolve the issues and we could put in place financial controls so that they could operate effectively and efficiently, utilizing our monies as well as any other monies that may come their way.
Online, we have Lindsay Walter.
Excuse
from
me,
the just a minute, Representative Gardner. We have Lindsay Walter from the Department of Law. She's available for questions since
thank
this
you.
Was run since it was turned over to the Department of Law. Perhaps
okay.
Ms. Walters could answer a question along those lines.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Carter.
Ms. Walters, thank you for being there. Did you hear my question?
Yes, through the chair. I did hear your question. This was originally referred over to our criminal department, and I am in the civil department, so I didn't really participate in the review of this particular issue. So I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to comment very deeply on this issue.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I might.
Go ahead, Representative Gardner.
So it was referred to you after it was determined that criminal prosecutions were not warranted, according to the letter here signed, I believe, by Mr. Bates. And, you know, I don't want to take this too far. I just would like to know, and I think other members of the committee would be interested in knowing, just some sort of confirmation that the $250,000 was not misused, or that if it was misused, there were some sort of consequences. I just don't, I have this fear that things may be brushed under the rug, and I just like to make sure that that's not the case. Can you assure me of that?
Through the chair, I wish I could assure you of that. My recollection from working on this was that there was some ability to piece together some of the money and how it was spent, but certainly not anywhere near the total $250,000. And I believe it was because there was some ability to piece some of this together that the concern became a little bit less that the CRSA had misappropriately spent the funds as opposed to just simply didn't keep up good bookkeeping. And so I think that's, you know, as Mr. Bates said, the goal is to get the CRSA back up and running. And with that in mind and with some ability to account for some of the funds, that was the determination to not try to go after the rest of the money and try to figure out how it was spent. It's impossible to figure it out. There's simply no records to prove either way what happened to the money.
Thank you. I don't want to take the whole committee's time on this, but it is something I'm interested in kind of knowing more about, and perhaps you'll call my office and suggest who I might ask for an answer.
Certainly, I can do that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Walter. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bates, we have an audit report that has a number of recommendations in there for problems with the program. You're telling us there's no suggestion in the audit that we fix them statutorily. This has been out since November. You're saying that you might consider doing something programmatically or regulatorily or procedurally. But you haven't done anything yet or haven't considered any changes, but we should give a six-year extension as the program is and think, I mean, I'm trying to figure out why we should have any confidence that if you haven't at least looked at these audit audit problems and come forward with some procedural fixes, that if we extended this for 6 years, we would have any confidence that not fixing them in statutes will get fixed by your procedures when there's been apparently no effort or nothing to come before us that shows us that there's any determination to make those fixes.
Through the chair, co-chair Seaton, I recognize my words were probably not appropriately used earlier in terms of characterizing our response to the audit. In fact, one of the audit recommendations was finish your consistency review regs. Do your consistency review regs. And we have those regulations prepped and ready to go out for public review, but we've held off on them a little bit to see how this process goes, the legislative process goes. We are, as a division, relatively not overwhelmed, but certainly at the ready to address legislative inquiries as necessary, and that has necessitated our putting those regulations off a little bit. But we do have consistency review regulations ready for public review and comment. Okay, and that was one of the recommendations. In addition, we have the ABC list, the list of expedited consistency reviews that is ongoing, and we just kicked off another process within the last, say, month to re-engage that process in a very heavy way so that we can make progress. And that is another one of the recommendations out of the audit, that we get that done. So those are two aspects we're working on. The audit also talks about the transparency of our functions with the working group. And while we hold monthly working group meetings, we have a little bit of concern with the audit in terms of transcribing or taking minutes from a working group function when, in our opinion, it's not necessarily a productive use of state time, and the working group wasn't necessarily set up to do that. We are looking at ways to meet more effectively with the working group. We intend to utilize the working group as part of the reg review committee, and we have also bought two tape recorders so we can tape the meetings and, as necessary, transcribe them or rebuild some of the dialogue that goes on there. So by no means have we taken the audits and shelved them. They're important to us. They're valuable to us. The processes were just recently completed in terms of our review and comment, as well as their finalization of these things. So one was dated first week of January. The second was dated the first week of February. So these are relatively new. We are considering them. We are looking at them in terms of what we as a division can do and what this body and the other might want to do. So.
Go ahead, Representative Seed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 24 of the first section, one of the things it says, overall, although consistent, DNR recognizes that the district plan requirements contained in 11 AAC 114 are more stringent than intended under HB 191. So, I mean, it's saying that DNR is recognizing that you have gone beyond the statute, or what was considered in the statute, what was anticipated in the statute. So have you done anything to roll that back or to change those? Is that part of the statutory or the changes you're proposing?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, and I've been on the record before you and other committees with those very words, that what was contemplated statutorily was implemented in a more stringent fashion through the regulations. And it's important to recognize that the regulations are still compliant and certainly fully supported by the statutes. But the way the regulations were manifested as they were written, they became more stringent just by a variety of different factors. Now, At the time, 2003, House Bill 191 went into place. We certainly didn't have the knowledge that marine mammals was as, I guess, fully regulated as it is. And, in fact, a state coastal program could not get into and manage marine mammals. We didn't have that knowledge. We do now. And that was part of the progression of regulation development and then implementation of these coastal district plans. A state cannot regulate that which the Marine Mammal Protection Act already regulates. That was something we learned through this process. And that's the type of issue that we that has been so challenging, and that's what has these regulations have been more limiting, I suppose, than what we contemplated back in 2003. Still compliant, but certainly more challenging to implement. These regulations, and I guess to answer your question more specifically, Representative Seaton, the ACMP regulations include state standards, and they include state standards at 11 AAC 112, and they include the coastal planning processes at 11 AAC 114. Those are processes that we could, as a department, initiate change to. And yes, we are considering those. We are considering the audit. We're considering how to address some of the things, some of the suggestions within the audit, whether it be procedural, whether it be regulation. And as I mentioned, as supported by the governor, we are willing to engage constructively with interested parties on statutory amendments.
Representative,
I guess following up, I'm just somewhat confused of being said we don't need to make statutory changes. The audit's identifying a number of things that are problematic, and yet what we're seeing is if we don't do them by statute, the probability is that you're not going to do them in your regulations or procedures. So, it just seems that if you're implementing things that are more stringent than were anticipated in the statute, and throughout this time you haven't backed off from those more stringent interpretations or more stringent, even though it's compliant than was anticipated in the statute, it seems that what we're left with is we need to make statutory changes to have the, or we need to incorporate those in statute. Otherwise, the what's intended in the statute isn't going to be followed. Can you clarify why that interpretation or why a misunderstanding between what you're telling us today and what the audit says and the recommendation?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I value your opinion. I also acknowledge and recognize the changes you might like to see, and that is, as I mentioned earlier, every one of you at the table, everyone on the phone, every coastal district, every applicant would like to see something out of the coastal program. When we contemplated changes back in 2008 under the reevaluation, we realized at that time we could not achieve consensus on program change because there are so many parties and they're affected so significantly with one minor tweak here, one minor tweak there. It is a package program that we're trying to construct, and a change here has dramatic effects elsewhere. We recognize that, and we're trying to find the right mix of process and regulation that would relieve and resolve some of these issues. And I recognize where you're at. I certainly understand that your perspective is if we don't get it right, change the statutes, and that is one perspective. What we want to do as a department is make sure that the program as a whole is designed to be most effective for the residents of the state, not for one group here, not for one group there, but it is effective for the residents and appropriate given all of the interests that are out there, and that the changes are relatively consensus driven.
Just one more question, I guess. So on page 28, where it's identifying that the EPA in its reevaluation pointed out that the current standards make protecting the ecological integrity of the coastal habitats nearly impossible. Do you disagree with the comments in the in that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. That is a
on the top of, excuse me, there were some questions about where that is. That's it. Starts on the bottom of page 27.
Okay.
And is on the first paragraph in italics at the top of page 28.
Okay. It's through the chair, Representative, co-chair Seaton. It's not my place necessarily to disagree with the comments, because those are comments made by a staff at EPA that feels passionately one way or the other. From our perspective, one of the things that we raised in our comments back to the Division of Legislative Audit is, in order to have a viable coastal program approvable under the Coastal Zone Management Act, we had to demonstrate comprehensive and robust habitat management. And that was a very significant discussion point with our federal granting agency as to whether we were accomplishing that or not. And in 2003, 4, and 5, in order to demonstrate that comprehensive habitat management, we were able to show them our state authorities that are incorporated into the ACMP, the state standards that address habitat, and the important provision, important habitat, that is the state standard at 11 AC 112-300. And then as further supplemented by district enforceable policies. And so when you consider state law, all the authorities that are out there, be in habitat for fish habitat, all of the authorities within Mining, Land, and Water, Division of Oil and Gas to manage habitat, wildlife, transit, and other issues, we supplement it with the state standards, further supplement it with important habitat that is a designation that can occur during the consistency review of a project, further supplemented by district policies. We were able to demonstrate to OCRM at that time that we were managing coastal habitat comprehensively and robustly. There's no question that some folks would like to see even a greater degree of habitat management in the state, and we recognize that. We've heard it. It's in the district comments. It's in the public comments. And it's, again, for us, it's trying to find that balance where there's predictability and responsiveness in a program that affects everybody so significantly.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. They probably lead into more than two, but
no doubt.
First of all, it's hard for me to. This must be extremely difficult to do if we're giving grants of $250,000 to get this done. So this is just is that 3 years or is that the total for 3 years?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that was about $250,000 over the course of three fiscal years, 2003, 4, and 5.
Okay. Well, since most of them got their program approved. First of all, I don't understand why they couldn't use the grant to hire their consultant, first of all. I understand why you think that there has to be a person in the community that is this point person. I understand that part, but why they couldn't use a consultant is beyond me to use that money. But anyway, since that the main, seems like to me, that the main issue here was subsistence use, and probably if I was one of these towns, I'd get rid of my consultant and hire one that one of the other ones had, because they seem to be okay. I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not. But so it seems to me that we've got the majority of the program or the paperwork that was filled out was okayed, but the subsistence part wasn't. So in your opinion, how long will it take them to just redo the subsistence part? It seems to me, and I know that I can't fathom how difficult this is. I definitely know I can't. But, you know, so if some of them have just got to redo that part, how long do you think that this will take?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, One of the funding opportunities under the ACMP is called Section 309 funding, and that is federal funding that is specific to program changes. Those efforts and activities that would result in a change to the program, like an enforceable policy, like a state standard, like a particular implementation technique, and those are all particular. Those are all specifically described by our federal agency within their law. So we do provide funding and funding opportunities for all of the coastal districts and state agencies to make these types of program changes. Once Bering Straits has their district online and they're accepting funds again and they get their existing plan in place, we can then consider funding them for these types of program changes to incorporate subsistence information into their plan, to revise their plan, to enhance it in terms of designated areas or enforceable policies. We did, under our own project, we this past year were in an ongoing effort to identify relevant and appropriate subsistence information so that we can compile that on behalf of the districts and make them give them access to that data so that when they do want to do a plan revision, that information has already been blessed, it's already available, and it's an incorporation process. There is a public process associated with that type of program change, and depending on the magnitude of the change, it'll run about a 2 to 2.5 year process just to make sure that the local communities and the public that is affected by those changes has the right opportunity to participate. And that's the same time frame we've always had within the program well before I came here in 97.
I think that'd be enough. I don't know. I realize that. I don't realize the complexity of it. But they don't have to redo the whole thing. They just have to do parts of it, right?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, correct. At this point, they will have a fully approved coastal plan. And to make changes to it would take a targeted submission. They can revise one policy. They can revise a chapter. They can revise the information that they have within there, which they rely upon to develop their enforceable policies. It can be as focused or as broad as they want it to be. And we would work with them. And for those types of efforts, we wholeheartedly support the idea of consultants utilized to shepherd them through the process.
One follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
So did I understand you to say that you are going to release the wording of some of them? Like, for instance, if their problem was they didn't get the subsistence part right, but several others did, are you going to give them that information so that they can look and see how it was worded here so they can kind of do something similar?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, plagiarism at its best. We're certainly looking to compile as much information as we can in terms of success stories, other information that's out there that nobody's found. EISs are full of good information related to habitats or fish or wildlife or information. And so we are gathering as much information as we can that is meaningful, that would be appropriate for a district to utilize in either developing a designated area for subsistence use or enforceable policies related to that subsistence use.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Randy, do you know of projects that were opposed by the local districts that were allowed to proceed that eventually got the green light to go ahead?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, there are projects, and I think Juneau has, to recent memory, had one. There are others around the state that I'm aware of. Many times, districts, if they don't feel they can provide alternative measures which would modify a project into compliance, they simply object to the project. Our agency affords coastal districts and state agencies what's called due deference. It's deference in we afford great perspective to that agency or district that has expertise or responsibility in the field. So while a district may object to a particular project, if there's another agency that has greater experience or expertise or responsibility, we would take the district comments, provide them to the state agency, and ask for some position to help us craft a final determination. Our goal with consistency reviews isn't necessarily, certainly is not to object to projects. It is to modify them into consistency so that economic development occurs in the state, but we modify the project so we protect and preserve the coastal uses and resources that are important.
Just to follow up on that.
Go ahead.
So can you cite examples where projects got the go-ahead that were not supported at the local level?
Just through the chair, Representative Munoz, off the top of my head, I would say that there was the one I'm thinking of in Juneau, and again, I'm not positive that the city and borough of Juneau objected, but I believe it was a Lemon Creek project, and I think at that time you and I might have visited the creek at the same time to take a look at whether that activity was an emergency activity that required immediate repair within 2 to 3 days. And I'm very well aware that the city and borough at various times objected to that project, objected to that type of project. They didn't happen to be available at the time of our visit to the creek, but I believe that they had some serious concerns with the issuance of a permit and a consistency finding. While they weren't available and while we understood their concern, we made the decision that either we or the Department of Fish and Game made the decision that the activity to place riprap on a stream bank was necessary to protect the life and property of nearby residences. So that's potentially one that might be of interest. There are others that come to mind in terms of offshore oil and gas development where a particular district might have objected to an activity. The project went forward because in our determination trying to resolve the issues, we were able to move them forward, and in our opinion, the determination was we supported the determination of the applicant and issued a consistent finding. That there are circumstances like that, and if you want me to do a review of the list of projects, we could try.
Representative?
In general, though, does a project that is it does the objection of the local district generally cause the project not to happen?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. As I mentioned, the coordination process requires that we go out for public notice and solicit public comments. And so within the context of a consistency review, a coastal district and state agencies would look at a project. 30 days later, they submit their comments to us. Those comments, by regulation, have to be in a particular form. They either concur with the project and say that it is consistent with the ACMP standards and policies, or they object to it. And if they object to it, the regulation requires that they submit alternative measures that would bring the project into consistency. What can we do to modify the project to allow it to proceed only on a modified basis that addresses your interest or your concern? And so we work with the coastal districts, we work with the state agencies through that process to get their comments and then consider them appropriately. A district that submits an objection with no alternative measures is, of course, challenging for us because what they're saying is that there's no way to stipulate this project into compliance, that there's nothing that this project can do to allow it to move forward. And that's certainly a position of some of the districts. It's certainly an option for them. And if that's the only way that we can move a project forward, and if in our opinion as the coordinating agency the project does not comply, we don't issue a final consistency determination concurring. We would issue an objection. But what we as a coordinating agency have to do is work with the district, work with the commenter, the state agency. We also have to do an evaluation determining compliance with each of the state standards and district policies that might be applicable to this. So a district may disagree with our perspective, or a state agency may disagree, but our rationale is going to be included as a legal document within our determination, demonstrating how and why we found it consistent with that standard or that policy. Okay.
All right, at this time, are there any other questions for Mr. Bates? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And be up to you to determine who would be the best, whether it be Mr. Bates or someone else. But, you know, I thought that we were going to get an overview, some schematics, some flow charts of how the program works when a project's come forward, whether it's a complicated project or a small project, who are the participants, what are the timelines, those kind of things. And I don't think that the committee, at least myself, although I have some familiar with the process, I do not have a good understanding currently as to how the coastal zone process here in Alaska under the current regs is working. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about these things, but I see some questions on other people's face around the table as well. And so I would sure like to get something coming back with, you know, some examples of flow charts, something that we can look at, showing the participants, here's a project. We could use some examples of past projects, a small one and a large one, maybe a municipality and a not municipality, so that we can understand before we go forward and try and solve the problems that the have been brought to us by the districts, that we understand really fully how the project, the current process is. So, Mr. Chairman, I would really hope that we could do that. And then the other thing that I would like to request is that we have the legislative audit, we have the legislative auditor, and I think it would be helpful to all of us to get our legislative auditor to come explain the audit and what those recommendations mean and how they coordinate, and so that we fully understand what that audit means from our perspective as a legislature. So those are the two requests that I would like to see us, so that we can really understand the program as we go forward.
Okay, thank you, Representative Seaton. Duly noted, and I concur. I think we would all benefit from a sort of a step-by-step explanation of how the just the mechanics of the program and what the people seeking consistency reviews have to go through, or seeking consistency determinations have to go through in the review process. At this point, we're about out of time. Thank you, Mr. Bates, for your testimony. And just a note to folks in the audience, this is this is the beginning of the public discussion on House Bill 106, and I'm sure we'll be receiving quite a bit of information over the next couple of weeks. At this point, we'll meet again Wednesday, March 9th at 1 o'clock in this room, and we'll be considering House Bill 60, Geoduck Aquatic Farming Seed Transfer, and HB 105, the Southeast State Forest issue. So with that, at 3 o'clock, we're adjourned. So.